Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Paul Anastas, Assistant Administrator for Research and Development at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Ken Beecher. Paul, sustainability is quite important, and EPA has made many efforts to organize programs around sustainability. Could you tell us how EPA is incorporating sustainability, that theme, into its decision-making within the agency?
So one of the things that we've done in the Office of Research and Development is taking a step back and taking a look at the research programs that we've had ongoing. All of them are ones that have been reviewed and assessed over the years, doing excellent work, producing excellent science. But there's a question that we want to ask ourselves: that can we become even more effective by ensuring that these are mutually reinforcing? Are we getting the synergisms that we could be getting if we looked at things from a more systematic and systems approach? And that's really at the heart of sustainability, that very seldom do the environmental challenges that we're looking at divide themselves neatly into an air project or a water project. And so we are stepping back and have reoriented and realigned the entirety of the research portfolio, so taking this systems approach in order to understand our the questions that we're addressing and the way we define our problems in terms of sustainable systems.
So I actually was wondering what kind of scientific or analytic tools are needed to support this new operational framework.
Well, it's interesting because we went to the National Academy of Sciences last year to ask almost that exact question: how do we make sustainability operational at the EPA? And they've recently come out with a report called EPA and Sustainability, and it's sometimes referred to as the Green Book. And it lays a framework out of what are the analytical tools that either are available today or need to be developed in order to address our questions systematically. It's one that's a great report that I would recommend to all of your listeners. Things like life cycle analysis, and not only current cost-benefit analysis, but thinking through future costs and generational costs, and things like green chemistry and green engineering tools.
All right, Paul, you mentioned green chemistry. It's groundbreaking research. You are a pioneer in advancing green chemistry. But what is green chemistry, and would you highlight some of the 12 principles of green chemistry?
Certainly. So green chemistry really is the scientific topic that I've devoted my professional life to. In a sentence, green chemistry is defined as the design of chemical products and processes that reduce or eliminate the use and generation of hazardous substances. So more than anything else, it's a design protocol to ensure that we get all of the function that we want from our products, we get all of the capabilities and performance that we want from our products, but not the unintended consequences of excessive waste and toxicity and risk that has been historically a part of the products of modern life. And so this is something that's been developed over the past, 20 years. And there are networks around the world and research networks in over 30 countries. There's now 4 scientific journals devoted to the topic. It's being taught in universities around the world. You can even get a PhD in green chemistry. And so, but I think most importantly what's happened is that this has been adopted by virtually every industry sector, ranging from energy and transportation to agriculture and plastics and everything in between. And so that's the good news, is that it's shown that you can make environmental and economic progress at the same time through thoughtful design. I think the better news is that they're scratching the surface of the power and the potential of green chemistry. So for every one product that has been reinvented and redesigned, there are probably hundreds that have yet to go through this protocol. So I think the upside is very high, and some market analysts have projected by the year 2020, the green chemistry sector itself will be a multi-billion-dollar industry. So the 12 principles of green chemistry really do focus on not only the efficiency of a process, how you use less energy, how you generate less waste, but also the inherent nature of whether or not something's renewable, whether or not something's toxic. And it is used, as I said, as a design protocol to ensure that we're doing not only innovation, but we're doing innovation that's sustainable.
What are some of the examples of green chemistry in action? Could you give us some examples of where that redesign happened? And how does it, pursuing this approach, how does it support your overall sustainability mission?
So certainly, one of the things that that we see is that, for instance, in the area of solvents that are currently used in industry, solvents can be used in anything from cleaning to separating out products from waste and manufacturing processes, but they're also the highest volume and highest regulated substances. The area of coming up with alternative solvents is a very big thrust area for green chemistry historically, and there's been such projects as substituting liquid carbon dioxide, which you get from putting it under pressure and temperature, as a solvent for dry cleaning clothes, moving away from other solvents that might have certain health concerns associated with them. This is something that's now been taken from the research bench into commercialization, and there are dry cleaners who are doing this. It's just one example among many that we could talk about. Bio-based feedstocks and degradable plastics. As I said, virtually every industry sector is pursuing this. This is an essential element in assuring that, again, this goal of meeting environmental goals, human health goals, is coupled with profitability, competitiveness, and economic benefit. Too often, folks have been under the misconception, the myth, that we can't have both. It's a choice between one and the other. Green chemistry is belying that myth every day and showing that, yes, it's been demonstrated that you can do this through thoughtful design.
So as a follow-up to that, Dr. Anastas, I mean, you just mentioned health goals and health effects of that, of communicating that information on chemicals to the public through the use of various means, through the use and disposal of various means. Would you tell us more about EPA's IRIS program or the Integrated Risk Information System?
Certainly. The Integrated Risk Information System is a program that we use to understand all of the scientific information on various chemicals and communicate that in the form of a database to the public. This is something that's, yes, used in our regulatory programs, but it's also tremendously informative to industry. It's tremendously informative to the public, where we now have a database of over 500 IRIS chemicals that it provide the hazard information that can be used in such things as risk assessment. So it's a tremendously important program and one that we focus a tremendous amount of attention on and have made investments in terms of both people and funding in recent years.
All right. So you've mentioned the category of the chemicals within the IRIS program, and tens of thousands of chemicals are currently in commerce now. Hundreds more introduced every year, but only a fraction of those chemicals have been addressed adequately for potential risk. Would you tell us more about EPA's Computational Toxicology Research Program and how it employs advanced computer models?
Absolutely. CompuTox, for short, Computational Toxicology, is one of those groundbreaking research efforts that we have ongoing. As you mentioned, the ability to generate the toxicological data has historically taken maybe even a couple of years and many millions of dollars in order to get the necessary data. What computational toxicology or CompuTox is doing is using high-throughput screening methods, meaning rapid testing of a wide range, hundreds of bioassays, in order to get information much more quickly, not for one or 10 chemicals, but thousands of chemicals, literally, at perhaps as little as 1% of the cost. So this is revolutionizing the way that we think about it. Now, this is still in the research stage, but we're moving forward with this aggressively because we think it really can change the equation on understanding and getting the insights on the hazards that certain chemicals might pose. Now, one of the things that we always think about is how do we ensure that our understanding of problems informs and empowers solutions. This is a great example of how we not just know more about more chemicals in terms of why they're a problem, but how this information, how this dramatic treasure trove of information can be used in informing and empowering next generation design of chemicals. So instead of trying to assess how bad things are, design them so they're at least as least hazardous as possible.
So, Dr. Anassis, you just mentioned about the next gen of future opportunities, possibilities of VPA. So, obviously, risk assessment is an integral part of the mission. Would you tell us more about your efforts in the human health research to advance risk assessment capabilities?
Oh, absolutely. So, risk assessment really became codified and integrated into EPA programs almost 30 years ago, it has become the backbone of many of the decisions that are made and is embedded in a number of statutes. And yet it's a constantly evolving science being refined. And one of the things that the Office of Research and Development is working on is how do we understand risk assessment, not in terms of only your exposure to one chemical and what then the probability of an adverse consequence or a disease might be, but how do we understand things like cumulative risk and aggregate risk? So exposure to a number of different chemicals, because we are all exposed to quite a few chemicals during the day. How do we understand that and build that into our risk assessment paradigm? Aggregate risk, where it's not just the stressors that we get from chemicals, but other types of stressors that we encounter in our environment. This is an important emerging area, and it becomes profoundly important for how we integrate it into our programs on things like environmental justice and disproportionately impacted communities. We know that there are communities that do bear a disproportionate impact of the consequences of exposure to toxic chemicals, for instance. To do a good job of assessing that and generating the solutions, these next-gen models of risk are going to be necessary.
And can you talk a little bit about the Advancing the Next Generation of a Risk Assessment program?
That that program is the embodiment of these refinements to our risk models. Now, these the efforts that we're making build on some of the excellent work done by the national academies in the so-called Silver Book, Risk and Decisions, that came out of that. And so that program is focusing on the refinements to the risk assessment paradigm.
Paul, I'd like to delve more into your systems approach. And in particular, in preparation for this interview, I did research and recognized that you are fond of a quote by Albert Einstein around problems and awareness. Could you elaborate on systems approach and how you're fundamentally changing the way you address a problem?
You're absolutely right. One of my favorite quotes is, problems can't be solved at the same level of awareness that created them. And so the level of awareness that I'm often referring to is that the great accomplishments of science over the past 200 years that has given us the deep understanding of the world around us, that's given us the products of modern life, communications and transportation, these approaches have been basically reductionist approaches. Reductionist meaning you fairly narrowly define a problem and hold all things constant except that one thing that you're changing, and that gives you a very deep understanding. Now, that is absolutely essential. It's bedrock to many of the advances, and I would suggest insufficient alone. What we also need is an integrative approach, how we understand how these different systems interact with systems in very complex ways. Because many of the times when we only look at a reductionist approach, is where we wind up with unintended consequences. When we wind up generating energy, for instance, but wind up causing various types of pollution, where we generate new technologies that may accomplish one function, but wind up being a problem for our air or human reproductive goals. So the systems approach is just saying, let's step back, look at both the narrow focus that we're intending to accomplish, the narrowly defined performance that we're trying to accomplish, but also see how it interacts with the broader world, how it might have consequences for humans and the environment.
How is EPA pursuing a path forward in developing solutions to the nation's top environmental challenges? We will ask Dr. Paul Anastas, Assistant Administrator for Research and Development at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.